Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody, and welcome to another edition of CMC Radio. I'm your host, Rob May. Hope everyone's having a great day so far. It's Monday, 6:30 p.m. here on the East Coast in New York. Got a beautiful day outside today, and we're up for some nice weather here. And I'm very excited to say that to warm up our day a little bit, we'll be our guest for tonight, part two of a 12-part series that we'll be doing with her, Dr. Linda Groff. Linda, welcome back to the show.
Hi, nice to be here.
Yeah. And how have you been since we last spoke last week?
Oh, I'm fine. I'm good. I'm keeping busy with lots of different projects, working on writing and so on, and various
very
things
nice.
In the community. Yeah.
All right. Well, Linda, now, I know that the basis for our discussion is creating a better world and future for ourselves and future generations, and you've been a professor, and,
right.
You know, you clearly, you know, yeah, and an author as well. I mean, you've been in numerous publications, and you're working on your first book, and that should, you know, I'm sure people are itching to find out more about that. But just to get everybody into who you are a little bit and where you were from, why don't you share with us just a little bit about your background before we get into tonight's topic of technology as a driving force for change?
Well, I grew up in Michigan. I went to University of Michigan undergraduate. Then I went to the East Coast for graduate school, studied, got a PhD in international relations. And then I started teaching at different universities on the West Coast, first in Vancouver, Canada for a year, University of British Columbia, then Fresno State, University of Cal State Fresno, and then Cal State Dominguez Hills for a number of years. And now I'm just trying to put into books all the, you know, I publish a lot of articles, like 75 articles, I think, but I'm trying to get into books on future studies and evolution and other books on peace and how to create a more peaceful world, and also some things on unity, diversity, things like, you know, in different cultures, dialogue of cultures and religions and so on. So anyway, I put together this list. I think we're going to do 12 interviews all together around this theme of creating a better world and future for ourselves and future generations. So some of the topics come from future study stuff. Some of them will be coming from cultural diversity issues and how to create interdependence in positive ways. Some will come from peace studies. Some will come from consciousness things. So there's a lot of different topics we're going to be covering, but they all relate to trying to create a better world for everybody. Yeah.
Absolutely, sure. And you would think that people should know about this, right?
Well, yeah, I think, sometimes when people get frameworks for looking at things in new ways, that helps them to see how to deal with a rapidly changing world today. I mean, that's one of the challenges for everybody, is that we have accelerating change. And also, I think there are periods when old systems break down and new ones have to emerge, and it's not totally clear what the new ones are yet. And that creates, you know, some anxiety for people. And, I think we're in one of those periods again where, I mean, I mentioned this, I think, last time, you know, just look at our politics. It's not like it's been before. So
that's true.
You have two people challenging the dominant political parties who haven't traditionally been in those parties. And anyway, and technology is changing too, because things like Twitter, like Trump Twitters all the time, and that's a technology thing, right? And you know, I don't know if people remember the Kennedy Nixon debates years ago, but the people that heard, this is how technology can be important. People who heard the radio version of it thought Nixon had won, and people who saw the TV version thought Kennedy had won. And so, you know, technology can be important. Yeah. So, but today we want to talk about a lot of issues about technology, I think. And also next time we're going to continue on that. But, I can give a little introduction here about technology and then how technology drives different stages of human development as well. And next time we're going to continue about technology, but we're going to be looking at technologies that are impacting future human evolution. So that'll be a more far-out topic, but it'll be raising some really important issues that we need to be discussing more and people need to get educated about. But anyway, today...
Absolutely.
So the first question is, Well, science and technology. So science is really trying to understand the laws under which the universe and nature operate, you know, and technology is really trying to figure out how to apply those world, those laws in the world to manifest things. So, you know, technology is really more like tools, right, that allow us to do things. But as technology advances, I mean, I think as humans better understand the laws on which the universe operates, then we can create more sophisticated technologies based on that. And so over time, new technologies emerge and so on. Now, there may be some things from ancient civilizations like the Great Pyramids in Egypt. We still don't know how those were built. So there's technologies we may have lost along the way, too, and we should not get too proud of ourselves that, you know, we know everything today. You know, there may be important things we could go back and reconnect to that would be important, too. But anyway, in terms of technology, one of the most, you know, there's negative, positive, and neutral views of technology, which is interesting. So a negative view of technology is that it's the source of all our problems, and if we could just get rid of some of these technologies today, we could go back to a simpler lifestyle and everything would be better, you know. And then a more positive view of technology is that technology can solve all our problems. So there are people who come, you know, who fit in all these different areas. And then, you know, so no matter what the problem is, there's a technological solution. That's a positive view of technology. And then the neutral view of technology is that technology is basically more neutral in the sense that how it's used depends on the intentions of the people using it. And so whether they're trying to do something that's going to elevate and move humanity forward, or they're trying to do something, you know, for just their own power and so on and to dominate others, then that, you know, is a different use of technology. So in that sense, it's not the technology per se that's the problem, but the intentions of the people using it. So that's a more neutral view of technology, which I tend to think, you know, I prefer that somewhat. But there's another thing, though, that once you have technology, though, no matter whether it's used for good or ill purposes, it does extend their capabilities. And you can do more in a shorter period of time, you know, with technology than without it. So in that sense, it's not neutral, you know. Does
Absolutely.
That make sense?
Yeah, sure.
Yeah. Yeah. And in terms of future studies, a field I've been involved with for many years, you know, futurists are trying to understand change, and they're trying to look not just at the past and the present, but what kind of future do we want to create, which is, I think, one of the reasons I found future studies so interesting, and also because futurists are big picture thinkers usually. They're looking at how change in one area impacts change in other areas and so on. So it's a more dynamic whole systems approach to life than just looking at things in very narrow areas. But so futurists have looked at, you know, futurists look at the future of anything and everything, but they also tend to also look at technology a fair amount as something that drives change. And but before we go into this a little more, I'd like to just say that behind new technology is new thinking. Okay, so it's not just that technology is changing, but it's also that people have come up with new creative ways of putting things together that allows new technology to emerge. So the creative process is also important behind it. And there's another thing, Bucky Fuller, a lot of people are Buckminster Fuller, was a famous futurist who's no longer alive. But he used to say that the most sophisticated technologies exist in nature, that we don't really invent technology. You know, like he said, our thumb is, for example, a very sophisticated technology. And it's just mm-hmm. that, as you know, so if you want to try to replicate a thumb, or, you know, today people are saying, can we replicate even like a human brain, right, in a computer? That's a topic we'll talk about later, but it's a, you know. But the point is that as we humans evolve and can understand how nature and the universe works and the laws under which it works better, then we can apply those and get more sophisticated technology. So in that sense, we're not inventing the technology. We're discovering the laws of the universe, you know, and of nature that allow us to create more sophisticated technologies. So that's an interesting view. So then if we go on, it's sort of an introduction, I think, about why technology is important and drives change would be to look at what are the different ages that humanity has gone through. And, you know, Alvin Toffler is another futurist who became very well-known and quite famous. And he had two books particularly that became really blockbusters around the world and translated into many languages and so on. But Toffler's first book was called Future Shock. And he just said that there's so many things happening and we have to learn to sometimes say no to new technology and things if they're not a good idea. But his second book, which is kind of more based on what I'm going to cover today, was called The Third Wave. And that book, you know, put out the idea clearly for, you know, for a lot of people that we had gone through an agricultural age, then we had an industrial revolution and age, and then he called the third age emerging a post-industrial age, which wasn't very clear, you know, it's still saying it's after the industrial age, but what
right.
it has come to be called by many people the information age or communication age or whatever, and we're in the middle of that, but we're also moving beyond that as well, so at the end, I can talk a little bit about what might come after where we are. But in terms of different ages, I could just say a little bit about each one. Humanity had hunting and gathering for thousands of years. You know, we had little bands and then roving bands and then tribes and so on. But people were, you know, still not in one set location in terms of living and so on. And then people say that the agriculture revolution was the first great technological revolution because it allowed people to settle in one place, and then you had villages rise up and so on, and so people could
right.
then start. The key thing there was that people discovered that they could plant a seed, and it could grow, and that they could therefore, you know, sustain themselves and grow food in one location rather than being roving bands looking for fruits and nuts and whatever else, you know, or animals to kill or whatever, you know. So so that was a huge revolution. And I think that the agricultural age has gone through several stages. There's some stuff writing about Maria Gambutis used to be at UCLA about the goddess emerging in old Europe. But when you had the very, and you can go to Crete and places, or Malta, I've seen in Malta, you can see temples that look like a very well-shaped female body shape, you know, rounded and so on. And that
right.
seems to be correlated with the beginning of agriculture where people did have little settled little villages. And so that was the first revolution that happened, I think. And then later, the problem was there was nothing written at that point yet. So, you know, people have to kind of infer, you know, what was their cultural values and their spiritual traditions and so on. But you have to, you know, there's a lot of artifacts you can see and try to interpret from that. But then the next thing later is you got the rise of ancient civilizations. And they became more hierarchical, more complex. And then these civilizations, and they had much, you know, more sophisticated technologies too. And, I mean, if you look at, like, for example, ancient Egypt, I mean, or different in different parts of ancient India, what was India today, I mean, or China, or you know, any of the great civilizations, Sumer, Babylonia, and so on, they started whole new levels of technology. And then with that technology, they seem to have, you know, discovered, and people, there was a, then in that period, you had worship of gods and goddesses, more or less, you know, and then, but you also started to get the beginning of conquering other people and making them into your slaves, you know, to do work for you.
Right.
And
yeah,
which so it had maybe some good parts and not so good parts. But anyway, that's yeah. So we went through ancient civilizations, and then later we also got feudalism, which was still agricultural. You know, you still had people. Mm-hmm. You had serfs, right, working for feudal lords, and then you also had artisan class who made artistic goods. But so all of those seem to me to be part of an agricultural revolution in different stages, and then. Then you got the Industrial Revolution, which began in England and started to spread around the world. And it was based on discovery of coal as a fuel, which
mm-hmm.
also started to pollute the air and the water and so on. And so, you know, but the Industrial Revolution started to get the, you know, the view of the mass society and mass production and, you know, let's make everything be the same. Whereas in the feudal period before, you had artisans and every good was made by hand. So, you know, everything was a little bit different, but with the industrialization and machines coming along, right, and factories, system of production and so on, you started to be able to get, you know, just cookie cutters, you know,
right.
crank out goods that all are the same. And we got the man in the gray flannel suit and all kinds of the mass society and all kinds of stuff. And that, is, you know, just lasted a couple hundred years. And then we got the information revolution, which we're certainly still in today, although there's other things moving beyond that. But the information revolution was really ushered in by computers and telecommunications getting totally intertwined. And then a later extension of that is the internet today, where we have, you know, everybody's online all the time. And so the information age it's got a lot of new characteristics. One of the things that's important, a few more things about these different ages, is that each subsequent period is shorter than the previous one, which is interesting.
Right.
Like the agricultural age was thousands of years. The industrial age, 200 to 300 years, and the information age, 30 or 40 years. But we're already moving to things beyond, like genetic engineering and going to space and stuff like that, which and evolving consciousness. I'll talk about those later. But anyway, the agricultural revolution really began in the Mediterranean. The industrial revolution began in England and spread over on the Atlantic rim. And then the information revolution began more by the U.S. and then Japan, and, you know, then everybody else joins in, but that's more Pacific Rim. But anyway, each period gets shorter than the previous, so there is an acceleration of change happening today. And I'll give you an example of that. Like if somebody from Europe, let's say, sent a message to the East Coast, or let's just make it simple, then you have to have a ship bringing it across the Atlantic. But if you want to send a message earlier on in U.S. history, from, say, the East Coast to the West Coast, you have to send it by stagecoach or whatever, right? So you have to wait until it takes a while to get to the new destination. And then, you know, at that point somebody can reply, but then it has to get back, sent back, right? So there's more space between when you send something and you receive it and so on. So whereas today everything becomes almost instantaneous. You know, you can send a message immediately on the internet, right? And people can get it right away. And that's global now. So the result is that people can respond right away. So you can see how that's the way that technology really is speeding everything up a lot. Another thing is technologies, these information technologies, I think, are freeing us from having to be in a particular place at a particular time. You know,
right.
You can record stuff on TV when you're not home, or you can, you know, send an email and people can read it whenever they want. I mean, there's all these different ways today that, you know, people get freed, you know, people are freed from having to be in a set place all the time, or, you know, they can still be connected to the world, you know, from wherever they are too. So that's another thing happening. Let's see here. So humanity has gone through these different ages. Another thing that's very important, I think, I wrote something some time ago about, you know, Alvin Toffler's book, The Third Wave, is, you know, the one that popularized the agriculture,
right,
the industrial, the information age. But it's interesting that you can go through all the different areas of society and see that in each of those eras, everything got restructured. So these are big shifts when they happen. I'll just give a few little examples. I don't think I have time to go through a whole bunch of these, but maybe just an example. Like energy sources changed. In the agricultural age, people used renewable energy, like solar, wind, water, you know, and humans as slaves and so on and animals, so on. But, you know, that was the agricultural revolution. And then the industrial revolution, people shifted more because people discovered coal in the 19th century. And then the 20th century, we moved more towards oil, and, you know, natural gas. And now we're in the information age when we should be moving beyond. So the industrial age was fossil fuels, which are non-renewable. You know, there's so much in the ground, and you probably never take them all out because it'll get too costly to get the rest out. But first it was coal, then it was oil and natural gas. And they're non-renewable in the sense that once you use them up, if you do, then they're gone. And they also pollute a lot, you know, so that's another side effect that creates global warming today. You know, which is another big problem we're facing. And so we really badly need to move, for example, into more renewable, back to more renewable sources of energy. But they need to be, you know, today they can be tapped with much more sophisticated technologies. So there's all kinds of solar energy, wind energy, geothermal, you know, where you tap the energy from the heat of the earth coming up, or there's nuclear fission, or the splitting of the atom and the energy given off, and then nuclear fusion, where you fuse different hydrogen atoms together, and then you tap the energy given off, and so on. So anyway, the point is that we're in the information age, let's say, but we're still using a lot of the non-renewable energy sources of the industrial age, you know. But we're in a transition, but it's still we need to move towards renewable more and more. And another example, maybe, of how the examples, the family changing in each of these ages. Like, if you look at the family in the agricultural age, it was the extended family. You know, you had mother, father, you had different generations all living together, you know, living on the land. So you had big families living together. And then when you got later, the Industrial Revolution, we shifted more then to the nuclear family, which was supposedly mother, father working, mother at home not working, if you were
right.
Middle class and above, unless you were working class, and then maybe both parents had to work. But, you know, and then a couple children. And now that we're in the information age, there's multiple family patterns. This is a statistic that people always get shocked when they've never heard it. But, you know, like the nuclear family is kind of the image we have of the ideal family still, you know, father, mother.
Yeah, of course.
Yeah. But if you look at, I think it's something like even under 5% of U.S. households are actually the traditional nuclear family. And that's been true for some time. So, for example, you have people who are, if both parents are working, that's not the traditional nuclear family of the industrial age, you know, because the woman's working too. Or you have a certain number of people that get divorced, and then the children become part of multiple household patterns, you know. Or you get gay couples, or you get people living alone, or you get, you know, there's all these different patterns of how people have households. And so there's multiple family patterns, basically, rather than just the nuclear family that everyone was supposed to conform to. So there's more diversity today in the information age in terms of family patterns and so on. So,
which you think definitely helps, right?
Well, yeah, because not everybody, if you have just one model of how everybody's supposed to behave and conform to, and you don't quite fit that model, you know, then where are you? You know, you have to pretend you fit when you don't.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I suppose would be a way of looking at it. So there is more diversity today, and things, as I said, are also accelerating. There's so many areas one could look at, like I think in the very beginning of agriculture, you didn't have writing yet. I mean, in the hunting and gathering period, for example, you didn't have, you know, you had oral communication before writing, right? Where you just pass things down with stories from one generation to the next. And everybody had to learn those stories, and that gave you identity as part of a particular group. And then you got the beginning of agriculture, where, as I said, if you look at those very early villages of agricultural age, they didn't have writing yet. So we don't know, you know, we can't be absolutely sure, you know, how we interpret what they were about, because,
right.
You know, you have to kind of infer. But we did get writing came along, and then writing is a whole other interesting topic. I mean, we can talk about that more with culture, but, you know, some of the ancient civilizations, like if you look at Chinese and then Japanese based on Chinese characters, you had to learn, like I was in Japan for a year, you had to learn something like, they said, 1,800 Japanese symbols to be able to even read a newspaper. And then, you know, which is amazing. And then in our case, we have an alphabet with 26 characters, right? So it's a heck of a lot easier to learn to read and write if you have an alphabet. You know, but the problem is that in the characters, like also in ancient Egypt, you had hieroglyphics. And so they were visual symbols, not just, you know, at least originally, they were visual symbols, not just like an alphabet, which is, you know, the thing that there was a guy that wrote a book at one point about, what is it, what was on the goddess. He said that when we shifted to the alphabet, what happened was that we started to become very linear thinking, because in order to read, you know, characters in our alphabet, it has to be set order in order to get the words and what they mean. Whereas if you had more visual symbols that, you know, like there was only a much smaller group of literate people, because it took so much effort to learn to read and write, you know, with all those characters. But the communication was more visual, more whole brain. Here's an interesting idea, by the way. I have this thesis that now that we have the internet, you know, and we have the World Wide Web part of it, so you can put kind of, you can have on the internet today, not just written text, but you can have, you know, music, you can have visual pictures, you can have multimedia, you know, all kinds of things. So you can create, you know, whole different worlds. But I think in terms of the brain, like if you're just thinking linearly, like our, you know, with an alphabet, or our Western culture tends to be more linear, you know, then everything has, you know, past, present, future, everything is a set order. But if you start to, with the internet, in the old days, you would have, you know, writing that started with visual pictures that then became, you know, meaning for words, for whole words.
Right.
And so if you have visual things, that's the more right brain thing. So with the internet today, this is just my own little hypothesis here, but with the internet, it's very interesting because now you can bring the left brain, right brain back together, because you can do communication not just with text and language, but with visual pictures, music, all kinds of things that also taps the right brain. So maybe we could become more whole brain people again. Anyway, just an idea. So, yeah, I got off on a little tangent there about...
That's okay. It's all part of the discussion. Yeah, absolutely.
Yeah. And there's another interesting thing is, well, I'm going to talk more about the internet, but there's stages the internet has gone through that might be a little interesting for people. The first stage of the internet was by the Department of Defense and ARPA, Advanced Research Projects Agency, where for military purposes, you know, people wanted to figure out, basically the origins of some of the internet was that people wanted to figure out how to send a message from point A to point B if there was, say, a nuclear war and the pathway was blocked out or destroyed, then how could they create alternative pathways from point A to point B? That was some of the origin of the internet. And then later, it started to be used by academics and people to exchange ideas, you know, for their research and so on. And then the idea was just freely exchange information and without cost and so on. And then a later stage of the internet was business discovered, oh boy, we could use the internet to sell things, you know. And so then the internet becomes available to more people, but also to find a way to set up businesses and so on. And then a fourth stage of the internet might be just making it available to everybody, you know, to workers, the people everywhere, you know, so that more and more people, even in little villages in developing countries, could have access to the world, basically, through the internet, and not just be, you know, sort of a more isolated community. So that's all happening, and, it's kind of interesting, too. What's really kind of interesting, there's a guy named P.R. Sarkar. This is really bizarre, but he had a model based on the Indian caste system in India about how power can rotate, in society between different castes or social classes. And he went through these four stages, which are first the military, then the intelligentsia, the academics, then the business, the entrepreneurs, and then the people, you know. But his model, I'll go through quickly, but it seems that the internet has actually evolved following those same stages, which is really kind of weird, you know. But, you know, so he said each of these stages has a certain power and then something gifts they can do and then something they can't do well, which then leads to a new group taking power. But, for example, when you have a lot of chaos and disorder, the military has to take power to create order again. But then they don't have, this is the way this logic goes with Pierre Sarkar, but then they don't have a lot of super creative new ideas. So then the academics have to come in, and the intelligentsia, because they have lots of new ideas. Then their problem is they don't know how to get anything done. So then I laugh at that because I was one of them. And then then the business people have to come forward because they know how to get stuff done. But their problem is they get too greedy. And then the people have to rise up again and take power back. But then in the process, you can get some chaos again. So then the military has to, you see, you get the circle, and the military has to come back again. So it's a kind of a cute little model, but it's interesting that at least the internet seems to have evolved itself through those stages.
That's Well, so. Linda, unfortunately, we are out of time for tonight's episode, but we're going to have you back on next Thursday night, May 26th at 6:30 p.m. Eastern Time. So we will continue the conversation there. We'll be taking part two of technology as a driving force, all right?
Right, and we're going to look particularly at how technology is raising issues for future human evolution, where we go forward in the future. Yeah.
Well, all right. Well, again, Linda, thank you so much for coming on tonight. Everybody, please check out lindagroff.net for more information. And thanks for listening to CMC Radio. I'm your host, Rob May, saying see you soon and have a great night. Take care, everybody.
Okay. Thank you. Bye-bye.